You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We continue now with Jason Halperin's ordeal involving his unexpected encounter with the NYPD and the U.S. Patriot Act while ordering dinner at an Indian restaurant in New York's Times Square. Five gun-wielding, bulletproof vested, wearing NYPD officers stormed down the steps of the restaurant demanding everyone get in the back and show some ID.
As I was demanding to speak to my lawyer, which of course I felt was a right that I have, a woman walked over to me, put her finger right in my face, and said, "We are at war. We are at war. We are doing this for your protection. We are at war." The man that I stated, who kind of was the spokesperson for the Homeland Security Department, then put his arm around her to take her away. But
calm her down, of course.
Mm-hmm. And she was yelling. I could still feel her breath on my face as she was stating, "We are at war. We are at war." She continued to say this as she walked back to her computer. And as I just said, I recognize that either we were at war at that moment or the war on terrorism continues, but we have special protections. In times of national strife, we cannot have the destruction of our specific rights. They're here not for times of peace, but for times of difficulty. Mm-hmm. And that's what I would have liked to say to her at that moment, but I never had the chance to. One of the men sitting next to me was a South Asian man. I was able to ascertain that most of the people there said they were citizens and worked in jobs around New York City. And this man was a taxi driver. He said to us, "I've had this happen to me before. Please do whatever they say. Do whatever they say for our sake." After he said that, I stopped asking for the rights that I perceived that I had.
And so how did this all end up for you? Did it end up in that same day?
It did. I was held within the restaurant for approximately an hour and a half. Finally, one of the policemen and the spokesperson, as I call him, from the Homeland Security, walked me up the stairs, Ash and I. We didn't know where we were being taken when we were being walked up the stairs. And he apologized and said, "I'm sorry, I didn't think two people like yourselves were in this restaurant." You can only assume what he meant by that. What I've assumed is he did not think two Caucasian men were in a restaurant that obviously everyone else was South Asian. And as we walked out the door, they opened it, and we were back on a major street in New York City, and people in bars and laughing and joking, and the door shut, and there were six people being held against their will downstairs in this Indian restaurant. Following that evening, the next day, I felt it necessary to call the restaurant. Again, still believing that maybe the Homeland Security Department had some information that I didn't, and this restaurant obviously then would have been closed or so forth. It wasn't. They answered the phone, still delivering food for lunch. And I asked what happened, and the owner of the restaurant explained this was a mistake. He said it was a mistake, and I'm not sure how many people were held, but he did say it was a mistake.
Mm-hmm. Were any of those people released, do you know?
I do know that a few. I know that I went to the restaurant, and I've had now a few conversations with the owner. I don't know if he's the owner, the man that was there who worked at the restaurant. He was obviously released. The kitchen workers, some of them were released. The manager, or the owner, as I stated, he has difficulty speaking English, so it was hard for me when I kept asking, was everyone released? He kept saying that he's not sure, and I don't know if he meant he couldn't understand the question or if he's not sure if all of them were released.
Have you done any investigating to see if any of your rights were actually violated at that point and possibly pursuing some sort of legal recourse?
I have. There's possibilities. What I've found out, which in my paper that I wrote on this, there is I use the wrong word. It's lawful what happened to me following the Patriot Act. it's not legal. Legal would be defined by the rights provided by our Constitution. Of course, the Supreme Court would be the one to rule on this, and they haven't taken up any of the cases that pertain to the Patriot Act. So therefore, what happened to me was lawful. The taunting that I mentioned, by the sarcastic remark by the policeman, would not be, but pretty much the rest would be lawful. But there is possibilities of recourse for legal action, and I'm still exploring this.
Jason, do you or anyone that you've spoken to have any sort of sense of how widespread this sort of activity is? Was this an isolated incident, do you think, or is this sort of thing happening more and more and we just don't hear about it?
I cannot confirm myself, but I have spoken to some organizations that are very well respected in this country, the American Civil Liberties Union, the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Organization, and they've explained to me that these types of experiences are happening to people all throughout this country, that there are these types of raids, and it continues to occur in the United States, and I believe it is targeted against the vulnerable people in this country, and therefore it's people who are immigrants, who have fear of deportation. We know deportation's happening. We know people are being held in detention centers if they're South Asian and so forth. So it's happening to them, and therefore they're very fearful of speaking. Of course, the people in the restaurant, I've promised never to mention the restaurant, never give the address. And as much as they confirmed it to some of the press that I've spoken to, it's only on an anonymous basis. And they themselves do not want – they have a stronger case for legal action. And, of course, they don't want to. They're very fearful. They don't think what we perceive as rights in this country, that they don't pertain to them. And therefore, they would be targeted either by the government or by people in this country who feel that they would be terrorists just by the color of their skin or by their name or the way they look.
Did this feel like an anti-terrorism action to you when you were in the midst of it?
I didn't know what it was. Following now, speaking to some people, lawyers, they've stated they don't think it's an immigration raid. The reason they don't think it's an immigration raid is because they weren't demanding to see working papers. I was there, I should also mention, when they were asking to see people's driver's license. If someone didn't have their driver's license on them, they wanted their birthday and name. And one of the kitchen workers, who obviously didn't speak English so well, they were demanding this from him. And he was shaking hysterically and continued to provide the day's date, March 20th, 2003, March 20th, 2003, over and over. Of course, quite frightened. As I've spoken to lawyers, they've explained to me that they do not think it's an immigration raid because they would have been much more forceful on, well, do you have any working papers and so forth. And they never said that in the hour and a half I was there. It was therefore very much what I believe in some of the lawyers I've spoken to having to do with a Homeland Security Department investigation.
Any final thoughts on your part, Jason?
Sure. Final thoughts. I've been amazed by the outpouring of support. This article was started as a small email. It spread throughout the internet, and people have been so supportive. I've also done some research on my own now, and I see that we have a Patriot Act number 2 coming up, which is much scarier than the first. The government has the right to strip you of citizenship in Patriot Act 2 if you're providing material support, which would include providing money. And as we all know, in the 80s, the African National Congress was considered a terrorist organization. So if this law existed then, if you supported the ANC monetarily, you could be stripped of your citizenship. It's very scary.
Nelson Mandela's organization.
Exactly. And the other thing is there's something called the Sunset Clause, within the Patriot Act. Again, I'm learning all of this after this raid. The Sunset Clause, which is Orrin Hatch, Republican, I'm not sure what, which I think it's Utah,
mm-hmm.
has legislation trying to remove the Sunset Clause. But what it states is in 2005, the Patriot Act has to come up again for a vote by the Congress to ensure that they want to continue with it. So it's something we could push our Congress people. And I've had support from some Russ Feingold, a congressman. Tipper Gore, of course, wife of Albert Gore, sent an email that was relayed to me of wishes and support. So it's been really amazing how people feel very strongly about this issue.
Jason Halperin works at a New York-based international humanitarian aid organization. He stopped by Peace Watch's studios earlier today.
We interrupt this program with a special bulletin. America is now under martial law. All constitutional rights have been suspended. Stay in your home. Do not attempt to contact loved ones, insurance agents, or attorneys. Shut up.
Well, the sorts of events Jason Halperin experienced are a frightening indication of what's to come, says Nancy Chang of the Center for Constitutional Rights, speaking several weeks ago at a conference at the University of Massachusetts in Boston entitled War on Terrorism or Assault on Human Rights. Chang says that the sweeping changes imposed by several laws passed in the aftermath of September 11th have vastly eroded civil liberties and constitutional protections historically offered under the Bill of Rights.
The cumulative impact of these legislative and executive anti-terrorism measures has been a radical shift to the executive branch that has placed the Bill of Liberties in danger of becoming yet another casualty of the war on terrorism. As our personal freedoms give way, so have the political and democratic values that define us as a nation. The rule of law, openness, and accountability in government, public participation in decision-making, and tolerance for the expression of unpopular views. To complicate matters further, in the past 20 months, we have witnessed an alarming increase in government secrecy. As James Madison said, the accumulation of all power, legislative, executive, and judicial, in the same hands may justly be pronounced the definition of tyranny. The framers of our Constitution understood from firsthand experience that secrecy leads to autocracy and that its best antidotes are transparency in government operations. But rather than heed the caution of the framers, the Bush administration has exacerbated the dangers inherent to wartime powers and shielded their exercise from public and press scrutiny. 1 month after September 11th, contempt for openness in government and the informed citizenry it fosters became the standard operating procedure throughout the federal bureaucracy. In a memorandum dated October 12th, 2001, Attorney General Ashcroft encouraged agency heads to withhold information requested under the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, by promising them, "You can be assured that the Department of Justice will defend your decisions unless they lack a sound legal basis or present an unwarranted risk of adverse impact on the ability of other agencies to protect other important records." I'd like to read to you President Clinton's words from a decade ago, 1993, where he encouraged public access to records, stating, "The Freedom of Information Act was based on the fundamental principle that an informed citizenry is essential to the democratic process, and the more the American people know about their government, the better they will be governed." We've come a long way in the last 10 years. The Bush administration has also sought to avoid oversight by its co-equal branches of government, Congress and the courts, in direct defiance of the separation of powers doctrine on which our Constitution was constructed. Since September 11th, the administration has actually made a practice of refusing to cooperate with congressional requests for information on its anti-terrorism activities, prompting Republican Representative James Sensenbrenner to say last August he was about to blow a fuse and subpoena Attorney General Ashcroft to appear before the House Judiciary Committee in defiance of tradition. Senator Patrick Leahy, among others, have made it clear that they would be disinclined to consider Patriot II or any other anti-terrorism legislation as long as there are questions on how the DOJ, the Department of Justice, that is implementing Patriot I, remain unanswered. The centralization of power in the executive branch and its exercise in secret have had a chilling effect as well on First Amendment values, and in particular on the freedom of speech and political association. Precisely when the security of our nation is endangered, our commitment to the rights guaranteed by the First Amendment are most essential. Such moments force decisions on matters of grave consequence, and they demand and deserve vigorous and informed public debate and a full airing of diverse viewpoints. Ironically, it is precisely at such moments when the First Amendment has historically been abandoned in favor of authoritarian rule. Unfortunately, the present moment has not proved to be an exception. Attorney General Ashcroft fostered a climate of intolerance for dissent when he testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee in December of 2001, rather, that those who scare peace-loving people with phantoms of lost liberty only aid terrorists and give ammunition to America's enemies. Now, it is true that we have not seen the Bush administration reintroduce in Congress the Sedition Act of 1798 or the Espionage Act of 1917, both of which made it a crime to criticize the government. But we have seen the Bush administration, along with state and local governments, raise the cost of political activism through less direct mechanisms that managed to accomplish similar results. First, we have seen restrictions on protest demonstrations and brutal police treatment of peaceful demonstrators, which had the effect of deflating the vibrancy and energy of mass social movements. In my hometown, New York City, the police department has actively discouraged protests against the war in Iraq through several methods. When United for Peace and Justice sought a permit to conduct an anti-war march near the United Nations on February 15th, the police department unreasonably refused its request, citing two vague and unspecified security concerns and our Code Orange alert. They insisted on a stationary rally and made New York the only city in the entire world that could not have a march. Also, at that rally on February 15th and at subsequent demonstrations against the war, the police department has been using the criminal justice system with its attendant powers of arrest, detention, and prosecution to sweep up law-abiding demonstrators off the streets and subject them to false arrest and imprisonment, to interrogate demonstrators in its custody about their political affiliations and beliefs without providing them with Miranda warnings or right to counsel. The vagaries of the USA Patriot Act grant the government license to lump together the nonviolent civil disobedience of Henry David Thoreau, Gandhi, and Martin Luther King under the same banner with Al-Qaeda's ruthless murders.
Nancy Chang works with the New York-based Center for Constitutional Rights. She spoke at a conference in Boston entitled War on Terrorism or Assault on Human Rights. Special thanks to Mark Weaver of community station WMBR for production assistance with that piece. Returning from his Middle East trip last week, Secretary of State Colin Powell warned Syria that the U.S. would closely monitor that country to gauge cooperation in the fight against terrorism. His comments came after earlier threats from the Pentagon that Syria may become a target of U.S.-led military action for its alleged support of Palestinian resistance groups, as well as its alleged harboring of former top-ranking Iraqi leaders. But while political threats and compromises are traded back and forth between Washington and Damascus, average Syrians still have an overwhelming love of Americans and American culture. Over the past several weeks on Peace Watch, we've heard about the journeys of Scott C. Davis, author of The Road from Damascus, A Journey Through Syria, as he spoke with Syrian students, entrepreneurs, and taxi drivers on his recent trip to that country. Today, we hear his interview with an anti-war poet in the city of Latakia.
Munzer Masri served on the Golan Heights in the 1973 war and has emerged as one of Syria's leading poets. Some of his most powerful writing renders the details of military combat. In one poem, Masri wrote of himself in 1973, "He got into a war and got out safe, but fire shares his bed and smoke fills his dreams." Despite the serious subject of his poetry, Munzer is a cheerful man who supports himself and his family selling shoes in a storefront shop in Latakia. In his spare time, Munzer retreats to his basement studio where boxes of LPs are stacked in the corner and two walls are completely covered with cassettes and CDs, Munzer's collection of American and British classic rock, including every sound ever played by Bob Dylan.
Let's hear music. Do you know them for thoughts?
Thank you.
After dancing and singing along to the Four Tops in a karaoke voice that would win no awards, Munzer hunted for his favorite Grateful Dead album, Blues for Allah. As he flipped through a box of LPs, he spoke about the prospects for peace with Israel in the wake of the Iraq War. Was there any way that the Israeli leader Ariel Sharon could change his stripes? The man who invaded Lebanon in 1982, the man who stood by as 2,000 Palestinians were slaughtered in the Sabra Shatila refugee camp, did not appear to be a promising negotiating partner. Even worse was the point that the American president seemed oblivious to Sharon's history as a man of war.
This one, Bush, with his friend Sharon, especially when he says that Sharon is a man of peace. Sharon is a man of peace. I really, very simply, disagree with that.
While Blues for Allah played, Munzer offered a message to Jerry Garcia in heaven, sent greetings to Garcia's wife, whom he noted was now a very, very rich woman, and analyzed the Dead's musicianship, comparing them to the Doors and the Rolling Stones. Munzer was in a good mood, yet his high spirits eventually yielded. This was the fourth day of the Iraq War, and bombs were dropping on Baghdad as we talked. By the time Blues for Allah was ended, Munzer was more subdued. Looking past the Iraq War, he spoke of rich countries and poor, root causes of terrorism, chances for peace.
If some way or another I can give an advice to a president of the United States how to prevent terrorism, this was easy. Everybody was saying it for 3 or 4 decades. World must unite. You must help poor nations. You must try to give 1%. But unfortunately, the rich countries didn't help the poor country. It's the opposite. They tried to steal it. They took their oil and gave them papers. And some kind of papers between North and South and between rich countries and poor countries. After the Second War, the thing they must believe that the world is one. And when something is wrong in a very faraway country, other faraway country might get influenced. That's a fact. So they must help, not conquer or defeat or kill. That's not the way. And to have a clear aims. You know that Bin Laden was encouraged by United States when he was fighting Soviet Union. But when Soviet Union came out of Afghanistan, Bin Laden looked for an enemy. He didn't find only the United States in front of him. The United States or the Western country must not deal with those kind of people, those kind of terrorist people. They taught them to be terrorists. They gave them the gun. Otherwise, if the West have this straight and clear goal to deal with the third world and the poor countries, everything in the world will be good. And that's a kind of utopia. But without it, I don't think the humanity, the humankind will survive. I think people need some kind of utopia that rich help poor, that people who learn something teach other people who doesn't learn, and the world will be united. And I think there will be a solution, kind of a dream. But without this kind of a dream, I don't think me and you can meet, me and you can talk, or our sons maybe can be a friend. How can an Arabian make a friend with an American after 10 years, with this kind of leaders in Israel, with this kind of leader in United States? Look the difference between Mr. Clinton and Mr. Bush. Look how Mr. Clinton gathered Arafat and Barack. And you saw that funny scene when they going in a door and Barack was trying to let Arafat go first. And Arafat, no, he was laughing. And those two leaders, two enemies, can joke with each other, can be a friend with each other. That means everybody can be a friend to anybody. But you need an atmosphere. You need people to help you doing that. I believe in real America. I really believe it. I believe in Dylan and in Chris Christopherson. I believe in White Whitman. I believe in all those great men. I believe even in Sean Penn, of course, and his father too, and in Jack Nicholson too, and everybody. They are good people. They are against war. You must see it clear. You are against war, that means you are against war ever. Any kind of war, you are against any kind of war. You are now in the 21st century, and the human race had passed very bad, big wars, and you still believe that war is a solution, and you still believe that send people to die is still a solution. You send them one to Vietnam, you send them one to Korea, and you still believe that war is a solution. That's all I have to say.
Now you have to quote something from a favorite American popular tune.
Well, many tears had to fall, but it's all in the game. Well, I believe in the game of love, but I don't believe in the game of war.
Many a tear has to fall, but it's all in the game. Oh, what a wonderful game.
Scott C. Davis is the author of The Road from Damascus, A Journey Through Syria. He spoke with Manzura Masri, an anti-war poet in the city of Latakia. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA, James Morris and Benta Berkland. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback at peacewatch@pacifica.org. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.